Hi, this is What You Say in English, Season 3, Episode 39.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the last episode of this third season of What You Say in English, episode 39. I'm your host, Frank, and I have a very special guest today, Laura Patsko. Laura is a language and communication specialist with a particular focus on English as a lingua franca, ELF, and pronunciation. She's written and co-written several professional development books for teachers and has conducted linguistic research for quite a big chunk of her professional career. So she has spent over 15 years in the field, working in various roles such as a teacher, teacher trainer, and consultant. I think Laura might know this already, but her work has been fundamental in my labor with this podcast. If you've been following me for quite a while, you may have noticed that the role models that I choose to analyze in my podcast are non-native speakers of English. The way I tailor my feedback was actually modeled after attending one of her talks on pronunciation and giving feedback on pronunciation. Not only focusing on what needs to be addressed, you know, individual sounds, stress, problems with communication, but also offering positive and constructive comments on what learners do successfully. For quite a long time, I used the resources she offered alongside Katie Simpson on how to teach English as a lingua franca, with whom she wrote a book on how to write pronunciation materials and activities. So you can have an idea of why this episode is so important to me. But before we dive in into our conversation, let's lay some groundwork. We'll be discussing some complex concepts, and it's essential to have a solid understanding of these before we proceed. Firstly, we'll be talking about equity, diversity, and inclusion. These principles aim to ensure fair treatment, access, opportunity, and advancement for all people, while striving to identify and eliminate barriers that have prevented the full participation of some groups. The principle of equity acknowledges that there are historically underserved and underrepresented populations, and that fairness regarding these unbalanced conditions is needed to assist equality in the provision of effective opportunities to all groups. Secondly, we'll touch on the Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs. These are a collection of 17 interlinked global goals designed to be a blueprint to achieve a better and more sustainable future for everyone. These SDGs were set up in 2015 by the United Nations General Assembly and are intended to be achieved by the year 2030. We talked about SDG 4 in particular, which aims to ensure inclusive and equitable quality education and promote lifelong learning opportunities for everyone. Lastly, we'll discuss inclusive education. This is a teaching approach that adapts the content, teaching strategy, and classroom environment to accommodate each student's unique abilities. Inclusive education is about ensuring access to quality education for all students by effectively meeting their diverse needs in a way that is responsive, accepting, respectful, and supportive. In our conversation, Laura and I explore these concepts in depth, discussing their implications in the English language teaching industry. We delve into the importance of inclusivity in lesson planning, the role of identity in language learning, native speakerism, a topic that we talked about with Rachel Tsateri, and the impact of these goals, these strategies, and these principles on the ELT world. Laura has a wealth of knowledge in these areas, and she shares her insights on her website, where she frequently explores these topics and more. This episode promises to be a treasure trove of information for anyone interested in language, communication, and the evolving role of English in the world. It's an educational and insightful conversation that you won't want to miss. Stay tuned. Well, thank you so much, Laura, because it's been This season has been very productive because I've had quite a few people coming in to sit with me and have a video interview like this one. Mm-hmm. I cannot thank you enough.
It's my pleasure. I'm really excited to be here. I love listening to the last episode. So when you suggested joining you, I didn't hesitate at all.
Yes. And I was lucky that I caught you in between projects. So
yeah, that's true. I mean, everybody's busy, but this week has been a slow week for me. So it's actually really good timing to got time to chat.
Yes. And I'm actually preparing for the holidays and it's sunny in Madrid. I need to enjoy the sun and, the summer and everything. Good. So, Laura, I would like to start with giving a little bit of background about you. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about you? You have the Blackbird LXD website project, and how does that align with your work? Because I know that you've been also working with English as a lingua franca. I mean, a lot of things. So how do you frame all that work you're doing?
What on earth do I do?
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. I don't even know how to describe what I do. I have fun. That's what I do. I have fun and I managed to get paid for it. My background was in linguistics. I mean, my first degree was in linguistics. And after a few career false starts and different things, I decided to train as a teacher, and then I became a teacher trainer. So far, so conventional. I followed a similar path to a lot of people in ELT. So background in language learning and language teaching. I still teach and teacher train when I can, but rather than work full-time in a school, a few years ago, I had a really interesting opportunity that I just saw by chance to go and work with Cambridge University Press in their research team, which was something that just felt kind of like an interesting side step. I'd been doing a lot of teaching and training. I really loved it. And this was a way to kind of try to use a lot of what I'd been doing in the classroom and what I'd done on my master's in a materials context, which I hadn't done before. And then after doing that for a few years, I became self-employed because I soon realized that in the space of a decade or so, I'd done so many different things, all of which interested me, that it actually didn't make sense to have just one job and do one thing. I like to have many different projects. And so that's when Blackbird LXD was born, because as I went self-employed, I started doing a lot of projects also outside ELT, looking in general at how adults learn. So not just how they learn languages, but how we learn in general as adults. And Blackbird is a kind of a home for that. And LXD stands for learning experience design, because that's really what I do now, is I design learning experiences. And that captures the range of all the stuff that interests me. So sometimes that means, teaching a language course, which is an experience of learning. Sometimes it means doing teacher training. Sometimes it means doing research. So I do quite a few research projects now, through a kind of proposal and commission process with, publishers or council or things like that, where I look at either an existing course or existing content or just an idea and then help develop that, help evaluate it. So it's actually really difficult to say what I do because I try not to impose too many limits on it. Basically, if it's related to learning, I'm in. I just really like learning. I'm fascinated by how people learn, and languages particularly, but also in general.
Yes, I completely agree. I think languages is such a fascinating thing about humans. It's basically what sets us apart as a wonderful species. I know that other species as well communicate in their own way, but the way we, as far as we know, we communicate in such a weird and wonderful ways that it's worth studying.
It's also one of those the things where, like, the more you study it, the more you realize what a miracle it is that we ever understand each other, because it's so complex. There's so much happening, and you think, wow, it really is amazing that we can communicate.
Definitely. And sometimes miscommunicate things.
Usually it's funny, but when it works, when miscommunication works well, if I can say such a thing, then at least we can laugh.
Yes. Now, in terms of the work that you do, I know that you're working with EDI principles like equity, diversity, and inclusion. Mm-hmm. How does that relate to your project, Blackbird LXD?
Yeah, so this is an area that I think, just in terms of my life experience, my personality, I've always been interested in, but didn't really put a label on or didn't give a name to. So what is, I mean, for the purpose of this podcast, I think we'll call it EDI. There are many names, of course, as you know.
Yeah.
People refer to the concepts of equity and diversity and inclusion as IDE, DEI, JEDI, I think is one that I saw once. You know, there's many different things to call it. But EDI and the way it relates to my work is quite simple, really. It's just a belief that all participation is worthy. Everybody has something to contribute. And a big part of making that participation possible is changing the broader systems that we operate within. And this kind of systems change is really hard work. It's big work. It's big work in really small everyday ways. So in terms of my work and how it fits in, I think the concept of EDI comes in three main ways or three sort of broad levels. One is projects and, projects that are very explicitly EDI focused. So for example, I've done some projects working on developing principles and frameworks of inclusion that can be put into practice for a specific organization. The second level is kind of very EDI relevant, but maybe already in practice, something that's already happening and not necessarily something that we directly examine on a daily basis. So for example, for a couple of years, I was working as a language coordinator with an NGO here in Athens in Greece, where I live, called ANCA Project, which exists really for the purpose of inclusion and equitable pathways to employment and education. So just by existing and doing what we do, EDI is there every day. We don't necessarily stop and talk about it all the time. And then the third level, let's say lowest level, but in a way most significant, is just implicitly as part of everything else I do. So when I do any other work or promote that work, just by virtue of being interested in it, you know, I bring to all the work I do a lens, looking through this lens at what I'm doing, thinking, oh, that is that fair? Or how could that be done differently? Or who might be left out by that? And trying to kind of, you know, metaphorically take off those glasses and lend them to other people and share, you know, borrow their glasses too and say, how do you see this? Because I think it's quite important to bring in issues that I'm familiar with from EDI focused work, but which might be overlooked otherwise or in other contexts. And also encouraging other people to point out to me gaps in my own knowledge, my own practice, because, you know, I don't know, nobody knows everything. So in, like I say, in kind of little everyday ways. So like, for example, for this podcast, you know, I really like that you sent me in advance some questions, some topics to think about. That's very good practice for inclusivity. It's very easy to do. Many people need more time to process things before they're required to respond, and for many different reasons. So rather than saying, you know, I'm this or I need that, just the practice of sending things in advance can include a lot of people with a lot of different needs, and they're not always given that chance. So if you hadn't offered it, I would have asked for it. But I think that last point in terms of how this comes into my work is really important, because it's about recognizing barriers. And a barrier can occur at any time. A barrier can be a long-term, significant, systemic thing. It can also be a short-term, temporary, circumstantial, or transient thing. So that means, I think, if you just have a default position of openness and observation and patience and listening, that's super important, whatever context you're in. So whether you're, I'm working on learning design, or whether I'm in a language classroom, or whether I'm just standing in line and, you know, waiting for my espresso, it's, if we always operate on a kind of autopilot, the way we always do things, then we might miss noticing what someone needs at a given moment or what barriers they're facing, because we're not expecting them, or maybe they don't have those needs all the time. And I think that's a really important concept in EDI, and one that I've tried to bring into all the work that I do, is that awareness to just keep asking the questions. Always just keep asking the questions. Always ask, is there a barrier here for somebody who might be excluded? And do we, you know, do we want that? Because there are, of course, times where we deliberately exclude. I just want to make this point, and I think it's important to recognize that we often start from a default assumption that inclusion is a good thing. I think as a concept, it is. But let's think of an example where, you know, you're teaching a C2 class, super high level, you're working on material that would be completely impenetrable to a learner of, say, B1. But you're in a school and a learner of B1 says, I want to be in that class with that teacher. You know, we might make a conscious decision to deliberately exclude, but it's not because we haven't thought about it or because we're disregarding barriers or needs that learner has. So I think just having that general awareness to just always keep asking the questions, who is included, who is excluded, why, what difference does that make to their ability to participate fully? That's kind of how it comes into my work, I think, increasingly, is in those little everyday questions, those little moments, whatever the context.
I think it's very interesting the way you put it, because when you mention all those factors and elements, when, for example, the example that you just gave me, the C2 class with a B1 student, I think it's, or I look at it as a way of putting together all these previous ideas that we've had and we've always used in ELT, let's say mixed ability classes, or that kind of inclusivity that you have different levels of different perceptions in one class, but as a way of joining them, putting them all together and considering all the factors at once. I think it's very interesting. I know, for example, that the UNESCO, you know, that recently, quite a few years ago, they started with their SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. Uh-huh. And I know that big names in the publishing ELT world, like Macmillan, mm-hmm. Pearson, Oxford, mm-hmm. and Cambridge, I mean, they're full on with their SDGs. Mm-hmm. Do you see EDI as an extension to that or as a part of that whole umbrella term of SDGs?
Yeah, it's certainly related. I mean, SDG 4, I think it is about equal access to education. So I think there are certain underpinning principles about ensuring mm-hmm. that everybody has access to educational opportunity. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the issues with, you know, all labels, including labels like EDI or SDG, is there's certain areas in which they're really similar. There's certain areas in which they're different. Mm-hmm. And I guess that comes back to what I was saying about mindset. I think if we start from a position of how much we don't know, you know, keeping an open mind, asking questions, and having not just a mindset, but a kind of approachability, an openness, and demonstrate in our work and in our actions and in our being that people can come to us with new information and that information will be welcome and taken on board and reflected on, then I think we're more likely to be more inclusive, more equitable, more fair in all of the things that we do, whether it's because we're doing, let's say, an EDI project or whether we're focusing on a sustainable development goal or something like that. It's a kind of, disposition, okay. You know, just a, like a default openness. I'm not sure if that quite answers your question, there's definitely a link, but I wouldn't be brave enough to say exactly what it is because that could take a whole podcast season. I mean, what are you doing next season?
Exactly. Now, in relation to all your previous work on English as a Lingua Franca, do you see links to what you're doing now? Because I know that you know, people change views and perspectives about things. Do you see any link between what you're doing now with EDI and ELF, English as a Lingua Franca?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I think that's a really interesting question. That was one that immediately jumped out when you sent me things the other day to kind of think about before this podcast recording, because I invested a lot of energy, a lot of time for a lot of years focusing really intently on the use of English as a lingua franca, focusing on that in my teaching, in my teacher training, in materials development, writing about it, speaking about it, researching it. And I enjoyed that. And also, as I mentioned before, when I tried to summarize my career in about 40 minutes, I think it took me, I also know that I get restless. I like to look at lots of different things. I find many different things interesting. And there was a time when I started, let's say, focusing more on EDI related projects and thinking, almost feeling a bit like, oh my God, but what about all that time I looked at ELF? And actually I realized they're intrinsically linked for me in the way that I approach them. So basically, as my career's developed, but also just as I've got older, because I think this happens as you get older, you understand your life narrative in retrospect a little bit differently in the stories we tell ourselves. And I've begun to realize two common threads which tie together so much of what interests me and where I invest my energy. And those two threads are identity and inclusion. So it's been over 10 years since I first heard even the concept of ELF, as English as a lingua franca, or English as an international language, as it was called then, really.
Yes, I remember,
those days, back in the days. And when I sort of began to wonder what that meant for my teaching. And I remember that in the beginning, I think it actually, I wouldn't have described it this way at the time. I didn't realize what was happening. I was a lot younger. but I think it really hit me with a huge case of cognitive dissonance. So where I found it really difficult to reconcile everything I'd been taught and even believed so far about the superior knowledge of those people like myself called native speakers. And even the almost the pride that I had felt myself at discovering I had this, superpower I was never even aware of. There was a dissonance with that. And then the very logical and pragmatic fact that I was presented with, that the vast majority of people using English are not using it as their first language, that that doesn't matter. And that more importantly, they don't need to refer to what these so-called native speakers like me do when I'm using English in order for them to communicate effectively. And so when I look back on that kind of developmental phase, like this was bigger than ELT. This was a really personal experience. And I think that cognitive dissonance, which I recognize now as a really fundamental step in my career, but also like my psychology, my personal values, that was hugely important later in making a link between English as a lingua franca and EDI, equity, diversity, inclusion in my work, because I realized that over time that so many of the things in the world that made me want to work on them, those kinds of things that bother you in that like irritating way where you know something really matters and you feel desperate to do something about it, to actually improve the world that we all live in so we can all have better lives. Actually, so many of those things were really about exclusion and power, and more specifically, abuse of power, whether deliberate or not. I think any system that privileges one person over another for no particular criteria other than where or how they were born, that doesn't make no sense to me. That makes no sense to me at all. And so over the years, I realized that actually my interest in the use of English globally by so many people from so many places for so many purposes, it wasn't in opposition. It was actually directly related to a greater belief in the value of EDI, that, nobody should be or should feel excluded from society. Like there's room for all of us. It's not a problem. It doesn't have to be a competition or a fight all the time. So actually what I had at first kind of thought of like, oh no, have I lost interest in ELF? No, absolutely not. ELF is just one way in which a broader interest in inclusion or exclusion manifests in my work and in my life. So I think there's a very direct link. They're very related.
Yeah, I mean, I can see, for example, that it has an effect on the broader discussion of identity in language and learning and teaching. Uh-huh. I mean, as a teacher myself, also as a learner of languages, because apart from English and Spanish, I like learning other languages. I mean, I can see that it definitely affects the broader conversation that we're having. And I know that I think your work comes in good timing because we're not having only this conversation about native speakers and non-native speakers of English. Mm-hmm. We're also having other conversations that intersect, if you will, in terms of gender identity, which is all part of yourself as a person. It's not the ways you express yourself, not only language, but also part of your identity. Do you focus on that? I mean, when you think about designing experiences for learners, do you focus on that spectrum of things?
On identity?
Gender identity, language identity.
Yes and no. I think there's an irony in the word focus, isn't there? It's like there's a kind of paradox of wanting to focus on something that's so broad. It's like odd. There's like a kind of tension inherent, isn't there? And and I think maybe talk about, even though it feels a bit more vague, is a better term that I would use. The funny thing with everyday conversation, the stuff we talk about in between the meetings, is that we don't go into it necessarily with an idea of an outcome or a decision or a conclusion. We're just talking about stuff. And I think the cumulative effect of those moments in our lives is probably more powerful in building our identity, our mindset, our beliefs, than the more focused areas of interaction, like a project or a meeting. And so in terms of identity, it's funny that, like, when we want to, let's say we have a project in which we hold many meetings about learning resources and developing, and we want them to be inclusive. I find it kind of funny and ironic that it's in those timetabled sections of, you know, those little blocks of time we make in our day to discuss this issue of identity. That's important, but it's also kind of not where actually a lot of the identity development and formation happens. They happen in between those blocks of time when my lesson's finished and now, you know, everybody in the school wants to go to the bathroom and there's teachers and students all milling around and it's like, oh, how do I talk to you? Now the classroom door is closed. Now we're not in that kind of scripted situation. And it's at those moments where we, I mean, it's tragic, but I think it's true that we're maybe more genuine in our interactions and our negotiations of who we are and how we relate to each other. And that's what identity is. You know, who are we and how do we relate to each other? So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's a really, like, again, identity is just such a massive and interesting area. So complex.
Yeah, it intersects. I mean, as I mentioned, I mean, it intersects with not only you as a person, but also other people and the way, the language, the variety of language that you use, you know, that ability to, I remember my old studies in linguistics and that kind of, forgot the term. It's a cross. It's a code switching, for example. Code switching. You know, the idea of code switching. It all reflects the multiple levels that you have when you communicate with other people, and finding that connection with others. Yeah, I think it's super interesting.
And that connection with others. You know, others is plural, which means your connections are plural. And that means that your resources and your use of your resources has to be really flexible. And that's one of the beautiful things with language. And one thing that is, I think, at risk of being lost as we, for very understandable reasons, try to kind of simplify and reduce things to make them accessible and amenable to learners and to learning, especially at lower levels. But we have to recognize that when you are a proficient, user, not learner, but user, and, you know, you're both at the same time. So again, I'm simplifying. But when you are a proficient user of a language, you're actually very flexible in what you're doing because of all those different connections that you make with people at different times. And that shows up in phenomena like code switching or whatever you want to call it, is this idea that you make choices based on where you are, who you're with, who you are. You know, identity also changes and flexes over time as, for example, you learn more language or you meet new people or you get older and, you know, your ideas change and your experiences accrue. And so I think that's also related to identity, is that it, you know, identity, like language, is not one fixed concept. It's very complex. It's very dynamic. It's very interactive. And that's part of its beauty and also part of what makes teaching and learning so so hard. You know, where do you begin with all that? But I think it comes back a little bit to, you know, what I was saying before about this idea that, like, when you go into an everyday conversation as opposed to, say, a meeting, you don't necessarily have like a goal or an outcome. You're just alive. You're just doing it. You know, you're just on the path without necessarily a destination. And I think that's a really big part of kind of true communication, is it's not transactional necessarily, it's interactional. And that's also a part of developing our identity, a part of what makes it such an interesting area to work in.
Yes, definitely. In the beginning, you mentioned an example of how I gave you the questions that or the topics that we're going to be talking about today. Mm. And as an example of being inclusive, you know, mm-hmm. in those principles that you call EDI, mm-hmm. Do you have any other examples or possibly challenges that, let's talk about the possibilities in which a teacher can implement in their everyday classes, because it's in theory, for example, it sounds wonderful. It sounds like a complex thing because it's, mm-hmm. it touches on every single aspect, but in terms of lesson planning or you also give another example with a C2B1 class student. Do you have any other examples that listeners, for example, or teachers listening to the podcast might say, I can do that in my class?
Yeah, so you've actually modeled really beautifully another strategy that I always recommend, a linguistic strategy, which is simply defining your terms, spelling out your terms. So from the beginning of our conversation, you know, you didn't just say EDI, but you said equity, diversity, and inclusion, or, you know, by which I mean, or in other words. And this extends outside the language classroom too, of course, just making sure that if you're using concepts or words or abbreviations are a good example, because I think we intuitively understand that there's something missing there. I've just used a couple letters. It represents a few words. But being more explicit in what we're talking about is a really inclusive linguistic practice and strategy to ensure that who we're talking to understands the context we're in our mind as we're saying these things. Because of course, this is what I was saying before about how, you know, the more you study language, the more you realize, gosh, it's a miracle we ever understand each other. Because just what, you know, I will never know exactly what's in your head. I assume because we share a language and we're communicating that we're more or less understanding each other. But, you know, we might hang up the phone and you go away and you have a totally different impression of the conversation we just had. It's possible. So a lot goes unsaid when we say things. And I think the more explicit we can be in what we mean, what we're referring to or what we're not, that's one really inclusive linguistic strategy that we can all adopt, not just as teachers and learners, but with everybody that we talk to. So that's one thing. Yeah, sharing information in advance when you can is another. I'm trying to be as kind of concrete and practical as I can, because I know that people who listen to your podcast will be teachers. And as a teacher, I know you always want just one thing you can go away and try. But yes. Big caveat, it is much bigger and more complicated than this.
Yes.
But one other thing that often comes up is in the question of assessment. So this comes up a lot when talking about teaching, learning, and learning resources is what happens when somebody has to be assessed on what they know. And while I understand that there is not always a lot we can do as teachers, maybe we're preparing learners for standardized assessments that we don't design, for example, but for, you know, everyday homework projects or even activities in the class, those are all opportunities for assessing understanding, assessing learning. And the more options you can give a student in how they can demonstrate what they know, the better. And they don't always have to involve loads of extra prep from the teacher or, you know, making extra worksheets or designing extra activities. Sometimes it's a simple question to the learners. You know, I'm going to give you a task to find out how well you understood, the reading we did today or whatever the thing is. Would you like to respond in writing or verbally? And give them a choice and let them choose. You know, they can either record it as a voice note or they can write it down as a paragraph or, you know, whatever. But simple elements of choice, it doesn't mean that that's the only choice the learner will ever make, but it also allows them to explore what they feel able to do and what they feel comfortable with as much as it allows you to see, you know, how they perform differently in different contexts and where their strengths might be. And in that sense, it comes back to what I was saying about inclusion being more systemic, more general, is the choices that we make or the choices that we offer are very closely linked to the barriers that people face. And, you know, you and I are teachers, we're learners, we spend our whole day obsessing about this kind of thing, but not everybody does.
Definitely.
And not everybody does that. And not everybody even knows themselves that well. Not everybody has had the experience of a teacher who's kind of open enough and offered them choice. And I mean, just having that choice can help the learner get to know themselves. That's the point I'm trying to make. And that is part of more inclusive practice, because it's about knowing and recognizing your needs and finding ways to meet those needs. And I think as teachers, we have a huge role to play in that bigger part of education, not just the language, not just the subject, but knowing ourselves. And the difference this can make is phenomenal. I mean, if you listen to someone like Martin Bloomfield, who talks a lot about dyslexia and his experience of being dyslexic and going through school and finding it so hard, and him getting to, you know, well into adulthood before someone ever told him that he was smart. And, you know, that you listen to him talk about it so passionately and so credibly and so movingly, and you realize the difference it can make for a teacher to recognize that maybe the reason you weren't able to demonstrate that you actually know something or can do something is because you were never given the opportunity to do it in a way that was actually accessible to you or comfortable for you. So coming back to your original question about, you know, what can teachers do? I think teachers can offer choice, and they can do it on a daily basis in very simple ways. And I think that's often why teachers who do have good intentions maybe don't feel like they're doing enough, because actually you don't have to do a lot to be more inclusive. And maybe that's why some teachers do, you know, they finish their lesson, they go, I don't know, was that enough? Could I have been more inclusive? Actually, maybe they were, because they did lots of little things. And, you know, it's that's the way to make a difference. It's a billion drops of water to make an ocean. You don't have to create, you know, huge waves. They come in time, but you can also make those little actions that show students that you're paying attention to them and that you're helping them know themselves.
I think it's great, because I can also see that everything you've just mentioned, I mean, I can see it in pre-service courses like CELTA or post-service courses like Delta, the diploma, including, for example, I know that there's been a lot of controversy lately in terms of learning styles or the multiple intelligences and whatnot. I mean, I know that in the curriculum for CELTA and Delta, I mean, that has been kind of a big thing.
Yeah.
But I can definitely see getting rid of that and including more principles like the EDI principles or sustainable development goals and things that are more inclusive towards the students. Okay. And for example, taking their CELTs and DELTs, taking their time to include that in their planning, include that kind of inclusivity in their lesson. I mean, after they do their profiles of their students and understanding their needs and whatnot, and then coming up with a plan that, of course, we're going to cover listening, reading, whatever, but I'm going to give them options in so as to produce the language, or, you know, just let the others know that, yes, I learned my goals for today's class. So I can definitely see pre-service courses and Delta courses definitely including more of that in the future.
And I think if they did, I think that would also help a lot of teachers as well as learners. I mean, the interesting thing is a lot of my earlier awareness of, let's say, accommodations is one word that's often used. You know, how can you adapt what you're going to offer to accommodate people's needs? A lot of my awareness developed from teacher training, also from teaching, but just certain memories come to mind of particular candidates on the pre-service. I used to train on the Trinity CERT TESOL, so the Trinity College equivalent of the Cambridge CELTA. And I remember having numerous trainees on that course who had, for different reasons, they'd struggled with different parts of the course, not necessarily the actual kind of content, but things that were required of them, like, you know, organizing these gigantic folders of lessons and handouts and essays and assignments. And, you know, I'll use dyslexia again as an example. It's just one possible way that someone's learning needs can present themselves. But that was really challenging for, I'm thinking of one trainee in particular who had very severe dyslexia, and was teaching brilliantly. It was so well received by the students, was so creative, so energetic. And when it came to the end of the course to put together all their assignments in the folder, absolutely broke down because that was so difficult for them. And it broke my heart to think, well, they're going to be assessed on the basis of what is actually a relatively small part of what we're trying to get them to do, which is to be a good teacher. So I think, you know, by including awareness of learning needs and barriers in the syllabus requirements for courses like the CELTA, the DELTA, the CERT TESOL, the DIP TESOL, and so on, you're not only going to make a difference to the learners, you're also going to make a difference to teachers. And that's really important too. You know, we need to be looking out for teachers' needs as well and the barriers that face teachers.
And when it comes to, for example, exam preparation classes, you know, we talk about the washback effect and being creating a positive washback. So I can see this definitely as a way of this inclusive mindset. I mean, creating or fostering a more positive washback in terms of exams, because I know that sometimes students can get really anxious and you know, worried about their exams and high stakes exams. Mm-hmm. So definitely I can see it fits in just perfectly. Is that the future that you see in ELT and you know, this kind of principles?
It is what exactly the future? You mean like a better awareness of EDI and of needs and barriers?
Do you see more of this in the future of ELT?
Broadly, yes. I think general awareness and, again, talking about, let's say, these issues is improving in some ways in some circles. I do think we need to be realistic and recognize that something like, you know, inviting students to say what they need is not always going to be popular or workable for a lot of teachers in a lot of contexts with maybe more expectations of a kind of teacher as authority, maybe with larger classes. There are many, many teaching contexts where that would be challenging. And what I've noticed from teaching and training in different contexts and cultures is that the expectation of what a teacher is or should be can make a big difference to what that teacher can really do, at least in a short space of time. And in many contexts, the teacher and the learners don't really have enough time together to really get to know each other, explore a working relationship, make connections, and create a classroom culture of openness and access and inclusion. Because the reality on a day-to-day basis of inclusion is that it often falls to the teacher to do the work to make certain changes or to get the ball rolling, so to speak. And that it also often requires little micro challenges to the way things are done every day. And that can only really happen and make a difference when everybody feels psychologically safe. Yeah. So I do think that as an industry in general, things are moving in a positive direction. More people are talking about the need to be aware of barriers to learning. You mentioned publishers. You know, I know that in some recent Macmillan courses, they refer to universal design for learning principles, and they're trying to implement some of that in their resources. And I do also believe that language teachers are very well placed to make the world a more inclusive and equitable place. I mean, because we know what it really means to communicate, which is to feel the need both to speak and to be heard. And in theory, at least, we're good listeners. Maybe you don't always get it right, but, you know, we're trained to listen to what other people are trying to say and to help them find their voice. So if we really believe in a world where everyone has a voice and a place and everyone can listen to each other, then we're in a good industry to promote these skills. But I do think we also need to remember globally, there are vast differences between classrooms, contexts, and cultures. And just because, and again, there's a danger here, and I think we need to remember to keep our egos in control, that just because, you know, we have our name on a book or our name on a podcast, or we work in a publisher in that's based at least in a majority English-speaking country, that doesn't mean that somebody who's working with students in Senegal or Venezuela or Iceland or Taiwan is going to feel the way we feel about all those things we're putting on the page, and or that they're going to take for granted the things that we've taken for granted as good. And, you know, one thing that we do know from research is that whatever goes on a page, whatever goes in a resource, what then a teacher and learner does with it is largely unpredictable. I think it's a really good question and a difficult one to answer. And I do think that positive things are happening, But I think we also need to be realistic that these things take time. A lot of it's about mindset.
Yes.
Mindset and culture. And I mean culture, kind of small c culture, how it occurs in many, in a classroom, outside of a classroom, in a country, in a city, in a family, you know, that, and it comes back to what you're saying about identity. The question of how to be more inclusive is a very big question and starts with the implicit question, should we be more inclusive? And when we're having these conversations, we're often assuming that the answer to the first question is yes, because we're already convinced. But not everybody is. And that will take time. But that's okay. That's okay. That's life.
That's fine. Let's enjoy the road as long as we're trying to win it.
Exactly. Exactly. It's the journey, not the destination. You know?
I will stay with that, definitely. Let's enjoy the ride.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Laura, it's been a great conversation. You have no idea how much I've learned with you today.
So thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Yes. So thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, absolutely. And I'll share links and things to, I know I mentioned a bunch of things. So if you've got a place somewhere in your podcast that you can post links to the things you mentioned, we'll keep the conversation going that way.
Yes, I will definitely appreciate that.
Super. Thank you so much.
As we wrap up this enlightening conversation with Laura Patsko, it's important to reflect on the key points we've discussed and their implications. Laura's insights into equity, diversity, and inclusion, EDI, Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, and inclusive education have shed light on the importance of these concepts in the English language teaching industry. As she rightly pointed out, any system that privileges one person over another for no particular criteria other than where or how they were born, that just makes no sense to me. This statement underscores the essence of EDI, which is about ensuring a treatment, fair treatment, access, opportunity, and advancement for all people, irrespective of their backgrounds. It is a reminder that as educators, we have a responsibility to create an inclusive and equitable learning environment for all our students. We also delved into the Sustainable Development Goals, especially on SDG 4, which aims to ensure inclusive and equitable quality education and promote lifelong learning opportunities for all. Laura's discussion on this topic highlighted the role of the ELT industry in achieving this goal. Inclusive education, another key concept we discussed, is about adapting the content, teaching strategy, and classroom environment to accommodate to each learner's unique abilities. As Laura pointed out, the cumulative effect of those moments in our lives is probably more powerful in building our identity, our mindset, our beliefs, than the more focused areas of interaction like a project or a meeting. These insights from Laura not only provide a deeper understanding of these concepts, but also challenge us to reflect on our practices as educators. How can we incorporate these principles into our teaching? How can we contribute to a more inclusive and equitable world through our work in the ELT industry? As we ponder on these questions, let's remember Laura's powerful words. It's the journey, not the destination. This journey towards inclusivity and equity may be challenging, but it is a journey worth embarking on. For more resources and points of discussion from this episode, check out the episode description where you'll find links to all the relevant materials. This is the last episode of this third season of What You Say in English. I'll take a break for the month of August, but I'll keep active on TikTok. I really hope to start the fourth season halfway through September. So, until we meet again, bye-bye.